Hello, welcome to episode 4 of the Grass-Fed Podcast. This is Clayton Carpenter, here with Michael Richardson.
Hey, Clayton, glad to be with you.
Good to be with you. Glad to be here on the farm. What is the actual name? Do you guys have a name for the farm?
You know, we intended to always have a name, and here we're 7 years later and haven't come up with a name yet. We're waiting for that name that just feels right.
Very nice. So you've been here 7 years?
7 years, and we haven't got the name yet.
Not too bad. What brought you here? Where are we, by the way?
Well, we're here in the Cayo district of Belize, paradise on earth. What brought us here was the desire for warm weather, an English-speaking country. We like the diversity of the population. We like the history of the land. It really appealed to us in a multidimensional way.
Nice. So overall, we hear about the book now. We've heard about a little bit of political life. Where did all this start? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I'm a product of the American, great American Midwest. I had my childhood years in North Dakota, went to high school and college in Omaha, Nebraska, which is where I learned about the crime of which I wrote the book. And then I spent most of my adult life in Illinois, and moved to Boston with the millennium change. And then 7 years ago, moved down here to Belize.
What has been your favorite of them all? What would you prefer?
I like Belize quite a bit.
Very nice. That's why you're here?
Yeah.
Very good. So about the book, where did this come from? Let's jump right
to it.
The
book was a product of a 10-year labor. Two Black Panthers, Ed Poindexter and then David Rice, now Wopashedi Mondo Iyanwilanga, deceased, were charged with the murder of an Omaha policeman when I lived in Omaha. And I knew David, and I didn't think he did it, so I went to his trial. And it made it seem like he was guilty, but what did I know? Anyway, I moved away from Omaha not long after the trial, and I didn't lose any sleep over it, but every couple of years it would nag at me. Did my friend murder a policeman? And finally, about a decade ago, I decided to try to answer that question for myself. And I wrote to David, changed his name to Mondo while in prison, and he didn't even remember me. But he answered my questions, and he said if I really wanted to follow the story, I needed to follow the truth. And with that as my guide, I set out researching, and I've read hundreds of pages of police reports and thousands of pages of FBI reports and trial transcripts and interviews and everything I could get my hands on, and came to understand that they were innocent, that the trial that I witnessed myself was a sham, a miscarriage of justice, and it happened while I thought I was paying attention. So once I had what I call the guilty knowledge that innocent men were in jail for a crime they didn't commit, I was burdened to write the book.
And it took 10 years?
10 years.
Start to finish?
Start to finish.
And we're here in August 2018. So as little before you moved to Belize, you started the project?
Yeah, I had begun. I completed most of my research before I left the U.S. and then spent a couple years just absorbing it all and trying to sort it out and make sense of it. It's been a couple years trying to organize it. I didn't know how to write the book, what tense, what person, how much should be quotes, how much should be my own narrative, what order, to how to marshal all the facts. It was like a blank page multiple times. I just didn't know how to start. So I started making a timeline to organize my thoughts, and the book grew around that. And for quite a while, the book looked like an annotated timeline. And then one of the publishers that rejected me said, well, this isn't a book. It's scattered facts. So I had to begin weaving it into a more coherent story. And then I learned I'd used too many words. So then I had to chop it down. And the book's undergone dozens of revisions. And probably a better author would have needed fewer, but that's what it took me, and that's why it took me so long.
Interesting. So where does that process start from taking facts into your commentary without, you know, some people say, oh, you knew the guy, or that's your view, or you felt this way?
There's actually very little commentary by me in the book. The really? Facts speak for themselves. It would be hard, I think, to read the book and not conclude that these men were framed. And, I mean, that's the way I wrote it, but that really wasn't the intention. The intention was to record what happened. And that's what happened. Yeah. As best that I could determine, there's still a lot of missing pieces. Censored documents, redacted documents, destroyed documents. Things that just were here then and gone the next day. So we'll never really know the full story, but as much as I could put together is in the book. And I think it makes a pretty strong case that these men were framed for a crime they didn't commit simply because they were leaders of a Black Panther chapter.
And at this time, I mean, for most people my age now, they don't really understand what any of that was about. Explain.
J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, had declared the Black Panthers the most dangerous American organization and directed the full resources of the FBI against this group. And for several years, beginning in the late 60s up through the early 70s, the Black Panthers were public enemy number one. And large quantities of FBI resources, manpower, and money were spent not just investigating the Black Panthers, but actually trying to disrupt them. Counterintelligence operations, false crimes, blackmail operations. Some of the things that the FBI did ended in lethal outcomes for the Black Panthers. There was no regard for any sense of justice or fair play or the so-called American way in what the FBI did to the Black Panthers. These two guys just happened to be the leaders in Omaha. Their story was repeated all over the country. I just don't know about it, but I know about this one.
Interesting. So what were you doing at the time? Were you reporting at the time?
I was a VISTA volunteer in Omaha and working for the anti-poverty program and had come to know David. That's why I didn't think he would commit the crime. Cripes, he was almost like a choir boy. He was singing guitar masses when I knew him. A real mild-mannered fellow. About as decent a person as you could ever hope to meet. A person who talked about ethical things. Would he kill a policeman like that? And would he use a 15-year-old to try to do it? None of it added up. None of it added up. They said they found dynamite in his basement. Well, as he said to me, you know, if I made a bomb, would I have stored dynamite in my basement? I'm the chief suspect. Well, he's got a point. And then he says they found dynamite in my basement, they say, but there's pictures of my basement. There's pictures of the dynamite. But there's no pictures of the dynamite in my basement.
We're missing something.
The thing that really galls me is Mondo surrendered. And so when he was waiting to go to jail, a newspaper photographer took a picture of him standing by the jail elevator with his hands jammed in his pockets. Well, the first thing they did when they got him upstairs to the jail was strip him and then do a paraffin test on his hands. And the hands tested clean. But the pants that they took off him supposedly had dynamite particles in the pockets. Well, that newspaper picture, which nobody realized the significance of for 25 years, proved that when his hands were in those pockets, there were no dynamite particles. The dynamite was added to his pockets after he surrendered. And the newspaper picture proves it. And you don't really need to know too much else about the case. You look at that picture and you get the idea of what happened.
Interesting. So at that time, no one had the idea of the significance?
Nobody realized it at the time. And as far as I know, it's never been brought up in a court of law as an issue.
Are there other people fighting for this? Are you the only one?
Over the years, there have been a number of people that have championed this case. Angela Davis is the most prominent. In fact, she spoke about this case in July and August. She's been to Nebraska half a dozen times to visit the prisoners and has repeatedly called for their release. The film actor Danny Glover has visited the prison and called for their release. There have been a number of people that have gotten involved, but over the years, eventually they burn out on it. I mean, they've got a life to live. They've got other issues they're working on. They can't let this one thing control their lives. Like I let it control mine for a decade. So I guess I'm kind of a Johnny come lately, but I'm on the scene now.
But you've taken it the full distance.
I want to go further. I want to take it from framed, the title of my book, to freed. I want to start a frame to freed campaign. Get Ed Poindexter out of jail while he's still got a few years left. He's in his 70s. He's in poor health. He's been in for 47 years for a crime he didn't commit. You know, it's time for some justice to come to the situation.
I like that. What do you think about reaching out to Danny Glover? Donald Glover, right?
If I knew how to get a hold of him, I would. Remember that guy you visited in prison? Well, he's still there.
Send him a message right now.
Danny Glover, Ed Poindexter is still locked up.
We'll send you a book. We'll get him one. Perfect. So, interesting. So now he's in jail. There's no other work being done.
Ed has an application with the Innocence Project out of Kansas City. The National Innocence Project has got geographic areas they work on, and they like DNA cases. Ed's case doesn't involve any DNA, and his geographical area would be out of the Kansas City office, and they take 3 to 6 months to review a case. So as far as I understand, there hasn't been a decision made on whether they'll accept his case. And then, assuming that they do, that raises the question what to do, because Ed has exhausted all of his appeal rights. A new angle would have to be coming up with, and there was a person on death row in Georgia a few years ago, a guy named Troy Davis, and he actually got the U.S. Supreme Court to give him a hearing, to order a hearing for him. It didn't keep him off death row. He got executed. But it did get him in the courthouse after his appeals had all run. And so Ed may have an opportunity to do a Troy Davis-type appeal directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. But then that, you look at the composition of the Supreme Court, and you start scratching your head, and you wonder, well, are they going to pay any attention to a 50-year-old Black Panther case? I don't know.
Maybe the book's the key. So what is the compilation of the information? You mentioned a timeline with annotations.
Yeah, the book's got over 1,000 footnotes. I knew when I wrote it that I had to be able to document what I was telling, since I was largely just telling fact. Facts that people don't want to hear. And when I tell them it's these facts, they either get a sense of outrage, either over what happened, or angry that I'm telling them this, depending on their point of view, or their eyes glaze over, and it's more facts than they want to hear. Very few people have actually taken an interest in following the sequence of events and trying to really parcel out what did happen.
Interesting. So how can people find the book? That's a little bit more on the book.
The book is available on Amazon. You have to look for the full name. Looking up Framed will instruct you that there's over 50 books named Framed. More than one of them about criminal cases where people were purportedly framed. So it's Framed, J. Edgar Hoover, COINTELPRO, and the Omaha 2. If you look up that whole long name,
we'll have the link with it on.
Yeah, you'll be able to get it on Amazon. It's available on Kindle, and portions of it are actually available free on a chapter by chapter basis at NorthOmahaHistory.com.
Sweet. All right, so a little veer off the book. Let's walk a little bit. Okay. So one thing I've admired about you and Mary is your plant-based vegan lifestyle. Where did all that start? Where did the cooking, where did all that come from? Because anytime anyone meets you.
Well, Mary and I each had our own paths to becoming vegetarians, and we became vegetarians about the same time. I became a vegan before Mary did. Mary became a vegan after she signed up with me. 18 years ago.
So
it started when I was in high school. I would listen to vegetarians on the radio shows. When I was a freshman in college, about 19, maybe 18 even, I was in line at a fast food restaurant waiting to buy my hamburger. And I've been thinking about the radio show I heard the night before and all the good points the vegetarian had made. Points that I was now ignoring standing in that hamburger line. So I thought to myself, I don't have to do this. And I turned and walked out. As soon as I turned, a smile came over my face, involuntary smile. When I hit that door, I'm not kidding, it felt like I walked into a whole new life. It was like instant nirvana. I was just overwhelmed by the feeling of goodness that occurred to me by making that conscious ethical decision, which was a spontaneous, impulsive, on-the-moment decision to just turn and walk out. Gave it no more thought than that, other than I'd been reflecting on the radio show. And all of a sudden, I get this, you know, goosebump moment in my life going out the doorway. So I felt good, although I was hungry because I passed on lunch. I felt good all afternoon about it. And then supper time came. And I realized I had to confront this issue every single meal. So I stuck with the good feeling. And what was a spontaneous decision was a never look back change of diet.
And how did that transform into what you guys eat today, which anyone
Well, it transformed into a pretty poor diet for the first year because I had never really cooked on my own, being living at the folks, and now I'm not eating meat, not paying attention to balanced foods, eating a lot of junk food like college students do. So I was not a model of nutritional guidance for a while. And then would slowly get more educated. It took some cooking classes. Whenever there was a lecture on something nutrition-related, vegetarian-related, would seek it out. Started reading some of the literature. Started acquiring vegetarian cookbooks and just trying to teach myself things. And over the years, that has gotten fine-tuned. Dairy was the hardest thing for me to give up. It took me a couple of decades to give up, completely give up dairy. I liked ice cream and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I got over that. Now there's ice cream substitutes, non-dairy alternatives, which I enjoy, but I'm not hooked on the whole thing like I was. Some of the foods, cheese is one. It's hard, and a lot of people say it's hard for them to give up the idea of not having cheese. Cheese is actually one of the addictive foods. There are foods that are addictive. Chocolate. You've heard people describe themselves as chocolate addicts, and it's true. There's actually, you know, physiological stuff going on there. That's why you crave it. And cheese falls into that category. That's why people want it so much. And the texture of it, which they've grown to be really fond of, I now don't like that texture. So the textures that were taught and the tastes that were taught, it's hard to understand the interplay of what's really going on as you make food choices. When you're young, your food choices are made for you. When you finally get old enough to make your own choices, you don't let your intellect and your conscience be your guide. You let your tongue be the guide, and you go with the taste and what you've been taught. And things that can be learned can be unlearned. And so everybody, I think, should give themselves an experiment in vegetarianism or veganism, just to really see something different. What it's like not to consume meat, to take the life of another animal just because you got hungry or you wanted the taste of its flesh. So some of the foods that meat lovers love the most, I abhor the most. Bacon, they can't stand the smell of the stuff. It's burning flesh to me. Bacon lovers, they like that smell. Not me. I don't care for it. And then a lot of the other meats I've discovered, it's It's the barbecue sauce they really like. They tell you they like the barbecue chicken, but it's actually the barbecue sauce. I could slather that on a chunk of tofu and they'd like it too. So some of the foods that we're taught to eat, we're not really, it's not really the food even. It's just the tradition and the texture and the training that's been done around it. It's like the whole Thanksgiving ordeal. It's an ordeal for me because I don't like the emphasis on this one bird. Why that one day they pick on one single animal, a bird, a harmless bird, I don't understand. But I don't like it. I don't like to be around it. And so until I started doing vegetarian Thanksgivings, I would avoid the holiday completely. And then I realized, well, if you can't avoid it, just change it. Started going to vegetarian Thanksgivings and then putting on vegetarian Thanksgivings. And I guess every day should be a Thanksgiving and every day should be a vegetarian Thanksgiving. I don't know how I got on that, but that's where I'm going to stand.
What was the backlash from initially? I mean, because when I mentioned anything about, I'm not completely vegan, I would say 95% of my meals are. But even that backlash is fun to me because I like people, you know, like I like to, you know, riling people up. But how was it for you? I'm sure you got plenty of backlash.
Well, I used to be of the rile up variety, pretty strong. I mean, I would go out of my way to get in people's faces on topics, including vegetarianism. But I have mellowed, and I now understand that people need to arrive at their own decision. And while you can help them with that, a little goes a long way. And so I just try to lead by example rather than, I don't really preach vegetarianism anymore like I used to. I'm no less ardent about it. I'm convinced that it's a good thing. Just earlier today, I was involved in a little Facebook chatter to help promote my book. I'm in a Black Lives Matter Facebook group, to, you know, because my book's about some black lives. And I learn a lot from being in that group, and I'm proud to be in it, and I'm thankful I'm in it. But somebody posted a picture of a billboard by PETA, the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, and it showed a picture of a crab. This was a billboard in Baltimore. And it showed a picture of a crab, and then it said something about, please don't eat me, or I don't know. It was a vegan message, you know, let the crab live. And a woman that I'd previously had a regard for in terms of reviews on political prisoners and racial issues, and I've responded favorably to Facebook likes on things she's posted, she went ballistic about this billboard and saw it as a slap in the face to Baltimore's black population because they like to eat these crawfish or oysters or crabs. And I just didn't see it that way. To me, it was a billboard promoting veganism and happened to be in Baltimore and happened to be about crabs and probably was about crabs because Baltimore is a coastal city. But I didn't see it as any kind of a racial slap. She saw it as a gentrification issue and that they were picking on the diet of the Baltimore's black population, who apparently seemed to like crabs. Well, I stuck my neck out and said, no, I don't think so. It was just about veganism, and I don't think it had anything to do with gentrification or racism, unless it was some kind of ingrained white bias that is so undiscernible that you don't really recognize it. That could be. I know that exists. But I don't think it was an intent by PETA to slap the face of Baltimore's black community over crab eating. So anyway, all that bit of nonsense all came from me once again intruding myself on a vegan topic instead of minding my own business like I mostly try to do these days.
So you have advocated in the past through business.
If I ever get around to writing another book, it might be about veganism.
Yeah,
I believe it's something that is important for the future of the world. it would be much more efficient in terms of food sourcing to grow plants instead of animals for food. That's such a huge issue that is overlooked, intentionally overlooked, because of the power of the meat industry. Vegetarianism needs to be the way of the future. It needs to be read in there with part of the whole concern for the environment, the concern for other living organisms. We should try to go through life and inflict as little harm as possible. Harm on others and harm on other living organisms. If you believe at all in karma, and I actually don't, but if you do, what about the karma of all the dead animals? Why turn your body into a cemetery for the carcasses of dead animals? Eat living food, eat plant food, celebrate life. So there's still some vegetarian activism in me. I'm just not currently pursuing it.
Of course. No, I respect that. And what I was heading towards was, you've advocated through business. So a big thing for me is showing people that, hey, good food can taste good. Vegan food can taste good. Plant-based food can taste good. So through Vegemundo, it seems like you guys did a bit of that.
Yeah.
How did that start?
We wanted to open a vegetarian restaurant. It was always kind of a dream. It never got around to happening. We incorporated a business called Vegemundo that was going to be the umbrella. We even tried to operate it at the pushcart level. We never really got off the ground for lack of capitalization. So we ended up doing catering, which we could do out of our own kitchen. We did some interesting catering assignments. That's about as far as we ever got commercially. Mary's started a cookbook a couple of times and is closer now to being done than ever. I've got a cookbook in the back of my head, but I've got a couple other things I got to do first. But we're always experimenting with recipes and presentation and trying to keep learning new cooking techniques and ways to make things tastier and better. It's fun. Earlier, I think we were talking about trying to ask a chef, you know, I'm a single guy and I don't have much time, give me some quick, cheap, simple recipes. My message is actually a little different than that, and I've got the benefit of being retired and got the extra time. But my message would be to take the time. I remember when I was living a fast-paced life that sometimes it felt like life was passing me by, and I was just kind of watching a movie of my own life, and I didn't really feel connected to what was going on, except when I was fixing food. That was something that was concrete, and I could actually relate to. And now that's just expanded. Now each meal takes me 1 to 2 hours to prepare. I work on preparation and presentation and all the little fine touches. And the fast food concept, and I know the necessity of it, but if you can avoid it, or if you can take a day off from it, try slow cooking. And stop and savor the simmers, the tastes and the smells and the joy of it and the immersion of the three-dimensionality of actually cooking and getting your hands-on experience. It's a multidimensional way of enjoying food, the preparation of it. So that's kind of my current thinking on cooking.
Interesting. So big picture, what do you see? A lot of people laugh at me and say, kid, dream on, you know, it's not going to happen. How do you see this fast food generation? And it's not just one generation, the past two or three. But
well, I'm encouraged that and the fast food generation is here, and there's no getting around it, and it's part of modern and urban life, and that's a reality, and I accept that, and I understand that. Given that, there does seem to be a growing interest in the youth in particular for more alternatives and not just what mom and dad ate, but something new. And of course, marketing and the meat industry can twist that to perverse directions, and they do. But I'm seeing more vegan options now than ever before. It's happening all the time. You now see it as almost every good restaurant's got some vegetarian or vegan menu options. That didn't used to be when I was young. Not at all. You had to ask. It was never in print, never on the menu. Tofu, forget tofu. If you didn't live in a big major city, tofu was something you only read about, nothing you ate. Now tofu is readily available in a lot of places. Things like that have come along, and now the airlines are adding vegan meals when they give a meal, the few times that they do. And I even see some of the big meat industry fast food chains are starting to add a vegan option. And I don't know if that'll ever get me to go through their doors anyway, but it's nice to see those kind of developments. And as you go through a grocery store, it's easier to find more things to eat. It's amazing how many things are in grocery stores that are really not edible if you're interested in, you know, wholesome eating.
Someone walks into a restaurant, what do they order? They see zero vegetarian, vegan, plant-based options. How do you start?
You let the wait staff know that you're going to be a problem and that you're mindful of that and that you're sensitive to that. And especially if they're busy, you're apologetic and you're really not difficult, although it seems like you are. You try to convey all that in a sentence or two with your looks and body posture. And so you need the wait staff on your side. Okay, so you win them over. Then you appeal to them to appeal to the kitchen, because you never get access to the kitchen, hardly ever. You got to have that wait staff pulling for you. And you don't want the harried cook to see you now as one big more headache, one more special order. You want that cook to see you, that chef, to see you as an opportunity to shine, to get away from the standard crap that they're doling out and do something extra. And if you can get that message conveyed to the wait staff and that gets conveyed to the chef, you're in for a treat. If you fail along the way, either with the wait staff or with the cook, you're going to get something that's mediocre at best.
What's the typical mediocre thing?
Oh, they won't even know what to do, so they'll get you end up with something with carrots and cauliflower and something along that line.
What's the best thing you've gotten in a situation like that?
Oh, spectacular dishes. And I learned that art going to conferences. Usually the conferences, they're pre-done meals. You might get to determine if you want the pork or the beef, but you don't get any other choices. So what I do, and I don't do it too far in and ahead of time, because that gets you nowhere. You do it the day of the event, but you give them time. So if you're worried about lunch, you're going to stick your head in the kitchen about 9 o'clock and actually literally put your head in the kitchen. You go there, you find where the kitchen is, you stick your head in, and immediately somebody's going to come and talk to you because they don't want you in the kitchen. And then you make your peace directly with the chef. And when the meal comes and everybody's getting their beef or pork platter, out come with this magnificent plate for you. And everybody at your table wants your plate. They all oohing and aahing at your plate. How did you get that? I would say 9 times out of 10 at conferences, I've done better than the regular deal, not counting the meat problem, just in terms of more food and prettier and better. And when you travel, it can be hard. And when you travel to places where I came from, like the great American Midwest, it can be real hard. You can go into a grocery store there and hardly find anything to eat. It's a sad reality. What should be the, you know, breadbasket of America is not fixed up so good for eats. And you see it in the population. Man, the obesity of America. I didn't notice it so much when I lived there, but now that I've been out of the country 7 years, when I go back, I notice it right away. Man, so many fat people. And that's because of poor diet. That's what it comes from, poor diet.
So you guys are just back for dance camp, right?
Yeah, we just got back from dance camp.
What is that?
Dance camp is a 10-day to 2-week retreat, usually in August, always in August, put on by different barefoot dances in New England. They have a collective called Dance New England. And they put on this dance camp where 500-600 of the freest spirits in North America and other places in the world all gather and have fun and frolic, and vegetarian meals, I might add. Dance camp teaches dances that are not commonly taught. Egalitarian partnering, authentic movement, contact, improvisation, a whole variety of different stylings are added to dance and concepts. Dance choreographers come to dance camp for their own pleasure. And so there's nightly dances that go till dawn. And then there's 3 class periods during the day where dance is taught. And there's about 6 class options per period. So there's about 18 dance classes taught per day. You could only attend 3, but you have quite a variety. And it's just a marvelous fun.
All right, so there's a few things that pop in my head, stories I've heard from the past. You can say past if you don't want to talk about it. But the trip to the national convention that ended up with a few bandits in the back of a truck in a field.
Well, we're in the way back machine now. Way back. back in 1972, when I was 22, I decided to attend the Democratic National Convention. Well, I actually did get in on the floor, so I can say I attended a little bit of it, but mostly I just wanted to go there and have a good time. It was in Miami Beach, and sounded like a fun thing, and I was active in the Young Democrats, and knew enough people that I thought I could get in on the convention floor for a while, and I was able to. But I didn't really have a good way to get there, so I hitchhiked. And on my way down, I got picked up by 6 guys that had broke out of a county jail in Tennessee. About 2 in the morning, they picked me up. I thought they were sailors because they were all wearing uniforms, but those were their jail outfits. And it was a white truck. They'd stolen a truck from a construction company, and it looked like a government truck, so I thought they were sailors and headed back to base, or I would never have climbed in the truck with them. Well, anyway, I was with them till they got caught about 24 hours later, and it was kind of a madcap event, I'll tell you. They were planning on trying to burglarize a house and rob a bank, and I was kind of the odd man out, and it was a little dicey at times. And then when we got captured, the chances of accidental gunplay were high. We were surrounded by every kind of cop and weapon you can imagine, and one of them told me to lay down, which I did. And then another one told me to get up, so I start to get up, and then the first one comes back and puts a gun right on the back of my head and says, "I told you to lay down." So I laid down and I didn't even say a word. I'm not going to get shot out there just because I'm mouthing off. When we finally get to the jail, the sheriff says, "Who's he?" I said, "I'm the hitchhiker." Well, they made me sit around another day before they decided not to arrest me for hitchhiking. And I finally took the bus to the convention. Well, when I got down there, I ran into a reporter for the Omaha World Herald that I knew. And so I told him my story. And so he put that on the front page of the Omaha paper as local color for the convention. This tale of my journey to the convention, complete with kidnapping by jail escapees. Anyway, they went back to jail and I went on my way. And it's a good story and most of it's true.
Incredible. Next thing, you on the front picture of the New Orleans Jazz Fest. How did that happen? And you mentioned a few publications you wrote for. And
well, I had realized somewhere in my 30s that I'd been listening to the blues back in my 20s, but I didn't know it. Somehow I thought it was rock and roll, I guess. I'm not sure how I failed to understand that, but I actually was going through my record collection and I see these blues artists. So I started going to blues festivals, and then I started getting involved with the local blues society. And through that, I learned about the New Orleans Jazz Fest, probably the premier musical event in the world, each year in May. And so I went to the New Orleans Jazz Fest and fell in love with it. 10 stages of music. Even if you hop around, you're only going to hear 10% of the music. And there's world music and gospel music and jazz and blues and local Louisiana music and rock music. It's not just all jazz. There's three jazz stages, but it's a pretty good mix of world-class music. And because I've been writing for a blues newspaper, I learned about a photo shoot by a blues magazine out of Detroit, Big City Rhythm and Blues, was going to be held at one of the stages. So I show up and plant myself there in the front row, all costumed up to enjoy the party, and managed to make it onto the cover of the magazine. And that got me into a friendship with the editor, and I started writing for the magazine. And for 6 years, I did the feature stories for Big City Rhythm and Blues and had a lot of interesting interviews with musicians over that period of time. I gave up that when we moved to Belize. Belize was just too far removed from the American blues scene for me to be able to stay on top of it.
Makes sense. So what were some of the highlights of that rhythm and blues career as far as reporting? Some of your favorite musicians, anyone stick out?
Yeah, you hear just great stories. I interviewed B.B. King and Bobby Rush and Elbert Collins and Buddy Guy and Coco Taylor and a lot of the larger names of the blues of, you know, the last 20 or 30 years. And got to do histories of some of the notable music venues, Congo Square in New Orleans, the Dew Drop Inn in New Orleans, and places like that, Maxwell Street in Chicago, Helena, Arkansas, did a show on the oldest radio show around, the oldest daily radio show, King Biscuit Blues Hour down in Helena, Arkansas, still on the air. The only show that's older, and it was a weekly, was Grand Ole Opry. And just heard some marvelous stories in learning these things directly from musicians. I did one interview with Bobby Rush. He sang me a song a cappella over the telephone from a phone booth at the airport. It's been a joyful experience, and I learned a lot about just life, I think, itself, talking to these blues musicians. A lot of them had a hard life traveling on the road. Sometimes the travel was the hardest part. Ray Charles used to say, I don't charge for the music, I charge for the travel.
It's rough.
I do the music for free.
Man. You ever have dreams of, what's your music history? I know you play and fidget.
No, I've got no musical talent. I'm an audience. I'm a good audience, but there needs to be an audience, and I'm a good audience.
What about with your the lute? What's a lute?
I entertain myself making noises that most people don't like.
Okay, so how do we transition to the blues if someone's never heard it? What's a good introduction that doesn't scare people, doesn't get them too hooked right away, because we know that can happen, and they'll never listen to anything, any other music.
Well,
again.
My introduction was a guy named Sunhouse. I'd have to recommend Sunhouse since he introduced me to the blues. Sunhouse was a solo performer, mostly. He went into retirement for many years and then came back the last four or five of his life. He did preaching blues. Sunhouse was a preacher, and he did his own grab-at-your-throat versions of just simple music. He's got one, and I think you can find it on YouTube. The Revelator, the long version of the Revelator. Son House would close his eyes, and he would go someplace. He was in connection with the muse, and you could just feel that passion. There have been other musicians I've seen. I've been with them backstage, talking to them, frail old guys. And they step up to that stage, and that mic, the light comes on, and the mic goes live. And man, there's an energy there. There's a liveliness there that you would have never imagined 5 minutes earlier backstage talking to them. They limp up, and then pow, they go live.
So I have friends who are interested in that type of thing. How do people get backstage to interview someone? What's the process of being a music reporter, to kind of living the life, getting your foot in the door? How does that work?
You go to the shows, you talk to the doorman, you try to talk to the agents. Agents can get you interviews. Agents can get you passes. If you finally can get to some place that publishes, they can get you in to shows free, to do a review. So you start going to your local music club, write for your local weekly entertainment paper, do music reviews. They can get you in to see shows that you would have had to pay $20 for otherwise. You do a review on that. You spread your reviews around. I saw a review that I'd written a long time ago for a woman folk singer in Minnesota, Thea Evening, her name is. And she's on her website, right above her name, she's got my portion of my review right there.
Awesome.
Still, after all these years, she liked what I said. And get out there and do it. That's how you do it. You get out there and do it.
Awesome. So is there ever a favorite? You mentioned B.B. King, a little bit more on the music. Is there ever a favorite you talk to? Someone that, you know, do words ring in your ears from one of those musicians that kind of mentioned something that really hit home?
Well, when I interviewed Bobby Rush, he's a kind of a rock and roll, black gospel, nightclub guy. He mixes it all up. He told me he was a certain age, but I didn't get his birthday. So when I went to look up for writing the article, I always try to put the birthday in. Some people like that. And it was a different year than what he'd told me. So I looked around and came up with a couple different dates. So I called his agent, and he read me a date off supposedly a passport, and it was different yet again. So I did something I've never done before. I called Bobby Rush back, and I asked him, I said, "Bobby, you remember me? I interviewed you a couple days ago," and he had a great line. I'm sure he uses it all the time, because I heard it twice. He says, "I want to thank you for what you're doing, what you have done, and what you will do in the future." Kind of covers it all. So after Bobby gave me that line again, I says, "I hate to bother you again. I know you know your time is valuable, and you were generous with me already. But it's about your age." This long pause. He didn't say anything. And then I said, "I really want to get it right. You told me this. Your agent says that. And it says this in your official bio. What is your age?" Another long pause. He says, "Well, Mike," he says, "you've been good to me." And that was another line of his. "You've been good to me." I hadn't been good to him yet. I hadn't written the review. But he wanted me to be good to him. So Bobby says, "You've been good to me." And I was, you know, easy on the phone. He said, "I'm going to tell you because you've asked. What I told you was the truth, which may or may not be true." And then I said, "Well, why all these different ages?" And he said, "Well, When you're a young black man coming up in the South, and they tell you that you're too young to play in this club, you tell them you're older. And when you get a gig at a party and they tell you you're too old, you tell them you're younger. I've been lying about my age all my life, and it has served me well. Bobby Rush.
So what people right now are saying, what did he sing? What's favorite album, favorite song?
I'm going to challenge the listener to just look up Bobby Rush and sample around and find their own stuff. I remember one song, Two Trains on the Line, or Two Trains Running.
Nice.
You can't have two trains on the same line, but Bobby did.
Bobby did. Interesting. So what music do you listen
to? Bobby would take his tour bus and travel the nightclub circuits and then head back home to be in for church on Sunday. Not many blues artists were able to cross that line. It was either the devil's music or the church music. And Bobby did both. He just said, well, that was then and this is now. And they accepted him.
Interesting. What do you listen to now?
I have developed a fondness for what I'll call simple music. I still like to hear stuff that's heavily orchestrated and, you know, got all the nice sounds added in. But there's something to be said about a single solo musician and his or her instrument. And maybe that instrument's just the voice. You get a passion that gets confused with all the other stuff, all the extraneous add-ons. And I like passion in my music. I like to be close enough to see the musician sweat, and I want to hear that passion. I want to feel it. And if I don't, it's mediocre to me, no matter what kind of music it is.
So if you're going to go in tonight and put on an album for dinner, what would you put on?
We've gotten quite a bit into the concept of randomness. And got the whole music collection in digital format and hit random. It's kind of like your own programmed radio show in a sense. You don't know what's coming next, but you know it's going to be something you like. And I've developed a fondness for randomness. There may be one or two songs that come up that are not appropriate for the moment, and then you just, you know, go to the next tune. So I typically don't put on something for like that unless we want a calming thing, and then I'll deliberately put on some new agey kind of thing for calming music. If I want feel passion, I'll probably put on some simple primitive blues or some kind of, you know, earthy folk music. And then if I want to, you know, be a clean house and storm about, I'll put on something majestic like Wagner or something grandiose. But I'm content with what random offers me quite a bit. Random has become sort of my life view. I'm not sure that there is really a scheme and order to life other than randomness and how we respond to it. Randomness explains the unequalness and unfairness of life better than any other theory I've encountered. Why are there starving puppy dogs in the world? Randomness answers that for me better than any religious belief does, any sense of equity in the world. Life is not really about fairness, but you would like it to be. And so that's why I embrace randomness, because randomness isn't going to be fair either, but it's how we respond to it that's where we intrude the human element, the fairness quality. Kind of a long answer to a short question.
No, it's interesting. So your response, my mom always said, well, a lot of life happens around you. It's really about what happens in your head and how you react.
So I think that's true.
That being said, how have you learned in maybe, I guess, not react or react more calmly?
Well, one thing that I've learned that I didn't always used to know was the importance of balance. you have to be balanced. If you're imbalanced, you're going to pay a price. Somebody's going to pay a price. Now, you have to be imbalanced a little bit to get some things done. We call it focused, but that's a euphemism for imbalance. We call it high achievement, and you need to be a little unbalanced to be a high achiever. But balance is real important for your health, your mental health, and I think balance is important for the well-being of the world. We have to balance the costs of an activity with the outcome of the activity. And if that formula isn't right, if that imbalance is there, then we're not doing something that's sustainable. And balance is, I think, critical to our own personal lives and the future of the world. And right now, the world is seriously out of balance. We are using energy at rates that cannot be sustained more than decades, certainly not centuries. And for example, the oil. Once the oil's all gone, then what? God won't be making any more oil anytime soon.
What do you think about that? Have you spent time in your life advocating for things like alternative energy, or have you been more political and food-based?
I've been more political on other activities and haven't marched on those issues. I'm sensitive to them. I'm glad others are leading that fight. I pay attention and give my support. I've learned to have to choose my battles so that I've got any chance of making some kind of impact. And so I leave some of these things that should be on my plate to others, so that I can stay more focused on the things that I've decided to give attention to. It's a rationalization, I know, but that's how I triage my time.
No, it's good. So that being said, with your knowledge and life experiences that have brought you to understand what other battles there are, what battles for the listeners would you give? Give five battles that you think people my age should fight, whether it's food, whether it's peace, whether it's, you know, as in...
Well, you just hit two of the five right there. Food is a huge issue. There's probably 1 billion hungry people in the world right now while we're talking. 1 billion hungry people. They may not all be starving, but they're hungry. They've missed a meal. And a good many of those billion people are actually starving. And many will die from starvation right now, in our lifetime. On our watch, while we're enjoying abundance. And I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on anybody, but food is a huge issue, and it's one that's right now in our face.
How do we act on that? Most people are going to say, oh, well, that's...
I think right now the world still has the capacity to feed its own population. I don't know how long we'll be able to keep that up, but we need to change agricultural practices, and we need to deal with food distribution issues. Right now, food is not distributed equitably. Food is distributed on a capitalistic system. And while that has a certain degree of efficiency, it leaves 1 billion people hungry. So food, peace, world peace. I mean, war. Who needs war? If extraterrestrials ever came to Earth, they would condemn us all for the sin of war. We allow war to happen. Well, I say we allow it to happen. How am I going to stop it? How am I going to stop President Trump from pushing a button and blowing somebody up? I can't. But just the same, I'm living in this time. You're living in this time. We're all living in this time. We're all a little bit responsible. So we all need to do something to try to turn around this relentless push to war. The money spent on war and the devastation of war... Think of how much good that could do for the world. How much happier so many lives would be. So there's two of your five. War, peace. You name the other three. You were doing good.
I would say energy, but I'm not educated
energy
on the field.
Right,
I'm not
there.
Sure.
You got it. I mean, half of the world's oil is already gone in 100 years. It won't take 100 to deplete the other half at the rate we're using it. Then what? They won't even have oil to make plastic out of. Right now, We should be switching to alcohol fuels for liquid. Liquid fuels should not be petroleum-based whatsoever. And we've got to get with wind power and solar power. And if we can harness geothermal power, we need to be doing that too. I'm not sure that they've got the technology for it yet, but they may have. It may be available in some places. I'm not sure that we're doing all the tidal power that we could, but we've got to start using the tremendous forces of nature for our energy and not trying to suck it out of a hole in the ground. That's very short-sighted and doesn't serve our generation or the generations to come at all. So there's three of the five. Come on, we need two more.
Something screamed at me and said mental health. A lot of things like Logic, more hip-hop artists and more entertainers, and people are coming out and saying too many people are killing themselves. The whole idea of the lack of self-confidence and self-esteem and empowerment for people in the media and what people see is lacking. That may or may not be true, but how do you address mental health?
Well, that's probably the biggest challenge of our lifetime, despite all these big issues we've been talking about. And that is the reality that technology has introduced communication tools and skills that were never before even remotely dreamed of. And that has created opportunities that have never existed before for good. And I'm very hopeful that this new information communication technology can be used to bring about the world that we so desperately need. I'm very hopeful about that. But at the same time, those same communication tools misused can brainwash large numbers of people on a scale never before imagined. And that's not so good. In fact, that's very bad. And I'm not talking just about subliminal advertising and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about the constant saturation from all sources all day long. I mean, it's overwhelming. And you don't even realize it. Some of it comes in just so below the radar of recognition, but yet it's still there. It's increasing at an exponential rate. It's like a chain reaction. And unharnessed, unfocused, that is the possibility of leading us astray or allowing us to wander where we don't really want to go. And so that, I think, is the challenge, is using this new technology for the good, recognizing the potential for harm and the absolute reality of its ability to waste our time. We can waste time now like we've never been able to waste it before. And some wasted time is good. It fits into that balance thing I was talking about earlier. But wasted time when you're trying to make the world a better place, that's not so good. So we have one more. We've got energy, peace, food, communication. What would be the last thing that a person could spend some time working on? Themselves. It all starts with I, me, you. We're self-contained. All of us are our own world. We're only skin deep, but there we are. We're all born separately. We're all going to die separately. We're going to die individually. Maybe somebody will die when we die, but we're still experiencing our own death when it happens. If we're sick, nobody else is suffering. They may feel sorry for us, but they're not feeling the discomfort. We are. It's this internal thing that's we. And it's a mind-body thing because, you know, we're thinking about it. We're talking. Does the mind extend beyond the brain? Well, a lot of people think it does. The ESP and all the wavelengths and the good vibes and the karma and all that stuff. Or is it just contained inside the brain? And when the brain is dead, then the body is dead and the mind is gone. That's a possibility too. But either way, either if it's self-contained or part of something, a larger collective whole, it's still something that we have to internally process, cope with, recognize, deal with. And since there is that mind-body connection, our mind informs our body how it's going to feel sometimes, and sometimes the body informs our mind how you're going to feel. You get that queasy stomach when you're nervous about something. You feel that rush of adrenaline when you're scared. All these are real chemical reactions that are going on, and our thoughts are the same process at a different scale. All that's going on at once. It's a big, huge mix. And if we don't realize that and pay attention to it and abuse it and interrupt that natural evolved flow of all the little things that are inside us, if we intrude on that too much with extraneous stuff, whether it be loud music or hard drugs or alcohol or some neurotoxin or LSD or some pesticide, whatever the intrusion is, we have to understand that that's affecting the body dynamic. And we have to work with that. And we may have to suffer the consequences of it. I think too many of us don't really think about ourselves as an organism. An organism that we need to feed and nourish and rest and care for. Yeah, we know we got to go to sleep and we know we got to eat, but we don't really think about it as something that we need to cherish. If they say the body is a temple, well, a lot of the people are abusing the temple. And maybe that's the fifth thing that people could work on themselves. Do that extra exercise. Give yourself another moment of quiet time. Be alone with your thoughts for a moment. Try to see how long you can hold your breath. How long can you stand on your right foot? How long can you stand on your left foot? Can you expand that time just by practice? Can you expand that 15 seconds you can hold your breath to 30? Can you work it up to a minute in the bathtub? Those are little things, very little things, that we could all do to make ourselves more fit, mentally and physically, for the challenge of life. So I think that's enough to tackle for the day.
Interesting. Very cool. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate you and everything you guys have done for me in this farm.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to ramble on. Some of it might be a little coherent to some people.
But the big picture, people learn. That's what matters.
Well, you've got several different programs there.
Interesting. So who are you? What are you doing? How can people keep up with you?
My name is Michael Richardson. A lot of people know me as Sparkle, or Mr. Sparkle, as the custom is here in Belize. I can be followed on my blog, Richardson Reports, which is can be found on WordPress.
Perfect. I'll link that below. And any of your past, is any of your music work, is that put out? Any of your articles or reviews from back in the day?
All the musical articles I wrote were never published online. They were published in the magazine, and you'd have to find old hard copies of them.
Interesting.
So that's kind of already moved on.
The new phase. A quick few rapid questions.
Okay.
They call them rapid fire questions sometimes. Favorite fruit?
I like watermelon a lot.
Favorite baked good?
Favorite baked good? I like cinnamon rolls a lot.
Favorite place you've been in the world?
Well, I like Belize a lot. And my favorite U.S. city is New Orleans.
Favorite country outside of Belize or U.S.? Those are like givens.
I haven't traveled enough to have an informed opinion.
Perfect. Favorite? You don't drink coffee. You don't drink, do you drink teas?
I never developed a taste for coffee.
Do you drink like herbal tea? Do you drink any, what do you do for energy?
I mostly drink water for beverage. For energy, I eat wholesome food.
Favorite breakfast
for people? Leftovers from supper.
What do, if someone wants a cheap and easy breakfast, other than leftovers?
Leftovers from supper.
Oatmeal or toast?
I've gone either way. Neither would be my choice of preference.
Huh, what's your favorite breakfast?
Only leftovers one. From supper.
Well, breakfast food. Last one.
I like some fruit in the morning.
Interesting. Perfect. Well, we'll wrap it up with that. Thank you, Sparkle.
Okay, very good.
Goodbye, everybody. We'll link all the links and articles below and websites. Have a great day.
Thank you, Clayton. I've enjoyed being with you.
Thank you. See you, everybody.